You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
In Puerto Rico, there's adventure around every corner and natural treasures waiting to be explored, like El Yunque, the only tropical rainforest in the U.S. Get swept away by natural beauty and come away with unique stories that could only be experienced in Puerto Rico and that remind you why you travel in the first place. Visits end, but stories last forever. You don't become a part of the island, it becomes a part of you. No passports required for U.S. citizens and permanent residents. Learn more and plan your trip at discoverpuertorico.com.
Welcome to Stuff You Should Know, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Josh, and there's Chuck, and this is Stuff You Should Know, Lost on the Mountaintop edition. But not in Tennessee, because this has nothing to do with the Beverly Hillbillies at all.
Wow. That was a roundabout funny intro.
I didn't even know it was coming 30 seconds ago.
No, we are not talking about Tennessee. We are talking about one of the heroes of mountaineering and mountain climbing, certainly, Mr. George Mallory, and the great mystery, to me, unsettled mystery, yep, on whether or not he ever made it to the top of Everest.
Yes.
Everest.
Right. So,
oh boy.
Yeah, this is a tough start, Chuck, because I just realized what I referenced was the Davy Crockett theme, not Beverly Hillbillies. So everybody save your emails, okay?
Oh, that's right.
All Davy of you Crockett. Beverly Hillbillies cosplayers, save your emails. So, okay, we're talking about Mount Everest. We're not talking about Davy Crockett or the Beverly Hillbillies. We're talking about George Mallory and, to a lesser extent, kind of unfairly, but also kind of fairly, his climbing companion, Sandy Irvine. And George Mallory is extraordinarily famous, not just in the climbing community. He's a legend in the climbing community, Chuck. But you and I know about him. I knew about Mallory, didn't you, before all this?
Yeah.
At least heard his name, had a general idea about him, right?
Sure.
Name two other climbers. Exactly.
The guy from that Free Solo documentary.
Does not count.
And well, all the Sherpa. I mean, you know, Ed makes great pains to point out the Sherpa, but suffice to say, all you have to do is go back and listen to our episode, Sherpa Warm Friendly Living, mm-hmm, in which we dedicate an entire episode to the usually nameless Sherpa who are usually standing just out of frame, mm-hmm, of some white dude saying, yeah, I climbed Everest again, but here, go ahead and get your picture taken.
Right. And they just kind of slowly shove them to the side. But
yeah.
But despite your best efforts, you still managed to prove my point.
Yeah.
George Mallory is extremely famous. And up to his 30s, it did not look like it was going to go that way, because he started out this very famous mountain climber and mountaineer, an early mountain climber and mountaineer, too. That's something that I feel is a beat we'll hit throughout this episode, that these guys that Mallory was climbing with were using, like, they were making some of their own gear. They were figuring out mountaineering techniques as they went along. It was like a brand, yeah, new thing that people were doing. And George Mallory was among the earliest people doing that.
Yeah, there's that one, I don't know if it was a journalist or somebody, was talking about pictures of the actual attempt to climb Everest, and mm-hmm, he said these guys look like they had gone out for a picnic and were hit by a snowstorm.
Yeah, right.
And just in how they were dressed, you know, they were in like tweed jackets and stuff.
Yeah, and hobnail boots, so just like some leather boots with some spikes attached to them, like just nothing you would even climb a hill in these days, let alone Mount Everest, but that's what they were wearing. So George Mallory didn't start out as showing signs he was going to be famous. He was kind of a left-leaning, progressive, intellectual school teacher. He did rub elbows with John Maynard Keynes and Virginia Woolf from the Bloomsbury Group.
Pretty cool.
Yeah. But that was probably the greatest brush with fame that he had up until he started hitting Mount Everest and making that basically his stated goal in life.
Yeah. I mean, he got into hiking and mountaineering when he was in his late teens and really fell in love with it. But, you know, as Ed Keenly points out, it was, you know, it was such a new sport that people didn't even really know, like they haven't even charted like the highest mountains in the world up into a very, I mean, what I consider a pretty late point when you think about like expeditions that Lewis and Clark made. It was in 1852 when they finally figured out that Everest was the tallest peak.
Yeah. Like up to 1852, they were basically at the point of that one's tall. Oh, look at that one. That's a tall one too. Right.
Yeah, I wish we could put them next to each other.
Yeah, exactly. So there was actually a guy named Radhanth Sikdar, who was an Indian surveyor, who used data that the English had produced during their occupation of India to calculate just exactly how tall Mount Everest was, because they really did settle on Everest just by sight. They're like, that might be the tallest mountain we've ever seen. And indeed, it turned out at 29,032 feet, Mount Everest was in the mid-19th century and still is today the tallest mountain in the entire world. And they named it Everest after the director of the survey in India.
Of course they did.
Sir George Everest. But if you asked a Tibetan, what's the name of that big old mountain over there? They would tell you Chomolungma, which means mother goddess of the world in Tibetan. So even the Tibetans were like, this is clearly the world's tallest mountain.
Yeah, and of course they had, you know, their own names for it, but we generally don't know those names because they would come along later and just name it after just some dude,
right? But we
some Englishman.
I mean, Chomolungma, that's definitely one of them.
No, I know, but ask 10 people what Chomolungma is,
right? And name two other famous climbers.
Yes, but the long and short of it is, or I guess the tall and short of it is, they realized that Everest was the tallest thing in 1852, but big deal. They couldn't do anything about it. Mm-hmm. They could just kind of gaze upon it. It would be decades and decades before anyone even thought that they might be able to climb Everest, because here's the deal. Getting to Everest and climbing it is like ascending the peak is one thing, but just getting to that point is, I don't know, 90% of the battle.
I would say easily. Most people think you look at a mountain, you just climb up the base and go up to the side and you're done. But no, you have to basically traverse mountain ranges. Mountains just don't exist on their own. They're part of ranges. And you don't really think about it, but you have to climb all these other little mini mountains to get to the big mountain in the first place. And this can be walks of, you know, dozens or scores of miles. And not walk. It's not a straight walk over a plain and then you get to the edge of the mountain and you go up. Like, you're going up and up and up, and you're existing at higher and higher altitudes, which the English people who were doing this at first were not used to. So they were doing this with basically altitude sickness and all the stuff that comes with that.
All right, so let's go to 1920, and the stage is sort of set to where they feel like it might be possible to actually accomplish something like this. Mm-hmm. And the Royal Geographic Society got together with the Alpine Club to form, and they didn't like permanently come together, but they worked together to form the Mount Everest Committee to say, all right, let's give this a go, old boy. And they got permission from Tibet in 1921 to go on a scouting trip. And this was a trip where they would just kind of figure out how to climb Everest. Like, it wasn't like they just said, all right, let's give it a go and see if we can get to the top. Like, they had to take several trips just to sort of map out what they thought would be a feasible way to even try to get to the top.
Right. Apparently, no one from Europe had been within 60 miles of Everest itself. So this was all new, uncharted territory, basically, for these guys. And again, it's really important to say, like, we're going to be telling the story from the English point of view. And like you said, the Sherpa rarely figure into that. With the big exception of Tenzing Norgay, who officially was the first to summit Everest with Edmund Hillary. But these guys weren't doing this alone. They had depending on the expedition and how much money it had, scores to hundreds of Sherpas, like attending them, helping them climb, moving their stuff, and just basically making life much easier on these guys. That said, I really don't want to undermine the amount of effort and strenuousness that these guys, and talent that these guys underwent in just figuring out how to get to Everest to start on that first 1921 expedition.
Yeah, it's really cool to read contemporary accounts of what modern climbers think of Mallory and his not just tenaciousness, but his actual talent level and his climbing style was apparently very unique and just revered today by modern climbers. And you know, it's not to take anything away from what anyone does today, because what people can accomplish today is amazing. But they accomplish these things based generally on, you know, they can be taught by other people. And like, this is how it's done. Like Mallory and the gang were figuring this out for the first time. And by the way, I might have said Hillary instead of Mallory,
because
I'm just thinking of climbing hills.
Right. And we should just go ahead and say, just to get any confusion out of the way, Edmund Hillary summited Everest in, I think, 1953. We're talking about the first expeditions to Everest, again, in 1920. Mallory and Hillary, I don't believe, ever met. They were of different generations of climbers. But Mallory absolutely was considered one of the pioneers, as were the other men in his expeditions that he went on.
All right, so if I said Hillary, I meant Mallory. Are we all good?
I think we're good, yeah.
Okay. All right, so they got permission again for this trip in 1921, and Mallory was in his early 30s. He was included in this first group, and I think was really chomping at the bit to do so. He has a wife and three young kids at home, but really nothing could stop him from going on this first scouting trip.
No, and he was 33 on the 1921 trip. And he says basically, hey, dear, I'm going to quit my job and leave you and the children for, I don't know, 7 months at least to go on this expedition. See ya. And that's where he went.
But he did say to his wife, here's what I'll do. I'll take this picture of you, babe, and I will carry it with me always, and I will place you at the top of Everest to live there forevermore encased in ice when I get up there.
Yeah. And I'm sure he probably took it with him on the first expedition, but the first expedition wasn't planning on summiting Everest. But from what I gather from Mallory, he would have been down to give it a shot that first time out. Like, that's how obsessed with Everest that man became.
Right.
And he actually was really successful. The expedition was. This was, again, the first expedition by the English to map Everest, and they managed to do it. They managed to find a way onto Everest, what's called the North Col, which is a ridge that connects one mountain to another. And they found that North Col, which is the way still today, if you're coming from the north, from the Tibetan side up Everest, you still use that route that these guys mapped in 1921.
Yeah, and it's important to point out which side that they would have gone up then and what side you go up now, because there is a route that China kind of secured and basically has held that Americans can't go. Mm-hmm. And that'll be a key sort of later on in this mystery. So put a pin in that.
Yeah, because China invaded Tibet in 1950 and said, this side of the mountain is closed to Westerners. But this happened 3 decades after Mallory and his expeditions. So they were using that north route. And still to this day, the north route is considered technically more difficult because it requires you to spend more time at higher elevations with, you know, its attendant lower oxygen concentration, which makes the whole thing way harder. And then secondly, the way in through the north route requires 22 miles of walking just to get from base camp to the top, whereas the south route, which is what Westerners use today, coming from the Nepalese side, is about 12.75 miles of walking. Nothing to sneeze at still, but it just kind of underscores just how hard the things that these guys were doing with zero equipment.
All right. So I think it's a good time for a break.
Sure.
I'm going to finally sort out the difference between Hillary and Mallory.
It sounds like an 80s sitcom.
No. All right, so I'm going to work all that out and we'll be right back.
Stuff you should know.
Hey, everybody. It's halftime and the scoreboard is not looking good. You're feeling low and not sure you can pull out a win. And that's when you have to dig deep, lift your head up, and say to yourself, time to get back in the game. Pull off some bank heists and take as much of your friend's money as you possibly can.
That's right. The smash hit mobile game Monopoly Go lets you compete with your friends to get the most riches and the biggest empire. It's the Monopoly you love, but on your phone, anytime, with tons of new twists, including leaderboards to compare your progress to your buddies.
That's right. You can play on countless dynamic Monopoly boards. You can make your friends bankrupt by smashing their landmarks with a wrecking ball. And you can charge other players rent for your iconic properties.
Plus, you can even work with your friends to crack open community chests in tournaments to get rewards and climb the leaderboard.
So get back out there, put on your game face, and download Monopoly Go, now free on the App Store or Google Play.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai. There's joy in every journey.
Hey, everybody, it's time you heard about Squarespace. Squarespace has the tools you need to create and sell your own website. Whether it's an online course or custom merch, Squarespace has you covered.
That's right. Courses is a great program. You can start with a professional layout that fits your brand, upload video lessons to teach techniques and skills, and tailor your course with a powerful Fluid Engine editor.
That's right. With Fluid Engine, which is a next-generation website design system, by the way, it's never been easier for anyone to unlock unbreakable creativity.
That's right. And don't forget the commerce side, because after that, you can charge a one-time fee or you can even sell a subscription.
Yeah. So turn your creativity into income with Squarespace courses. And right now, go to squarespace.com/stuff for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, use offer code STUFF to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. Squarespace. And now a word from the show's sponsors at Betterment. Let's talk about hustle culture, shall we? You know, the whole rise and grind, go big or go home thing. It's a lifestyle that might not be for you.
That's right, but one that your money can handle thanks to Betterment. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle.
How? Good question. Their automated technology optimizes your investments again and again. With Betterment, your money is taking ice baths at 5 a.m. while you get your well-deserved rest. Your money downs protein smoothies and automatically reinvests your dividends, all before you head out the door. Your money is a workaholic.
But you don't have to be, because you've got Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. So visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
Okay, we're back. And I want to go over a little more about when you how you get to a mountain. And we don't have to go in great detail, but you're basically going up one mountain to get to that ridge that connects that smaller mountain to Everest, the taller mountain, right? But to get there requires hiking, mountain climbing, ice climbing, rock climbing, every kind of climbing you can imagine. And one of the first things you have to do, no matter whether you come from the north route or the south route, is cross a glacier. And that is way harder than it sounds.
Yeah. I mean, this thing is, you know, surrounded in part by glaciers. And like you said, there are so many different disciplines if you're going to do something like Everest, and especially in 1921 and 22, mm-hmm. that I just don't think we can overstate like the near impossibility of this feat at right. the time.
Yeah, especially with the glacier, there's crevasses. They can be really deep, 100 or more feet deep, and you can fall into that and die. There can be ice slides, also known as avalanches. They can come and bury you. There's something called, I think, seacores, which are house-sized blocks of ice that you sometimes have to climb that you could also topple and be crushed by. Like, that's just the glacier. That's like the first obstacle to get toward the mountain. And again, they were doing this with zero equipment.
Yeah. I mean, we did a whole episode on ice climbing, right?
We totally did. And I remember
that's why we talked about seacores.
Okay, good. All right. Yeah. I thought it sounded familiar. And I also was like, yeah, ice climbing is really hard. I know that from experience and researching it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this one, the Sherpa episode was really good. Ice climbing was good. I believe we did one on dead bodies on Everest.
Yeah.
And way long time ago.
We did one on altitude sickness too.
Yeah. So this all comes together. Point is, it's really, really hard. And there are so many ways to die.
Yeah. What else wants to kill you up there, Chuck, that they weren't aware of until that 1921 expedition?
The Yeti.
Yeah, that's where the Yeti was introduced, or at least the concept was introduced to Westerners who brought it back. Then I believe on a later, like 1951 expedition, a guy named Eric Shipton took some photos of what were supposed to be Yeti tracks. And that's when like the West really went wild for the Yeti.
That's right. So let's catch ourselves up. It's September 24th, 1921, when they reach the North Col. Mm-hmm. And this is where they're like, all right, we think this is it. We think we have found a path that can actually get us. They didn't realize there would one day be an easier path, probably. But they said, we think this is the way to go. Mm-hmm. And it should be noted that not only these expedition trips to sort of map things out, but each subsequent attempt to ascend Everest that ended up in I don't want to say failure, but I guess it is failure if they mm-hmm. didn't accomplish it.
Devastation.
But each one of those is really important too, because every higher peak that you get to, you're able to sort of establish, of course, not everywhere, but you're able to establish camps along the way.
Right.
And these camps are then used later on as, base camps like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, et cetera. Mm-hmm. In fact, 6 might have been the highest camp at the time, right?
Yeah, for sure. And then so...
But it's super important to establish that for like all the hikers to come. Mm-hmm. Just because it was a failed attempt doesn't mean a lot of great stuff wasn't accomplished.
Yeah, because if you are hiking or you're climbing up a mountain and there's a higher camp that you're coming up to, you can make your way over the day to that camp and then just stay there for the night. If there's not a higher camp, you have to turn around at some point and make your way to that next lower camp to survive.
Because
you cannot be caught overnight on Everest anywhere at these elevations that these guys are hiking at without a tent and or a sleeping bag, or you're going to die. That's all there is to it. A human being can't survive on the higher altitudes of Everest without that kind of stuff. So yes, establishing a camp is an enormous thing, but also they're learning stuff firsthand about how humans respond to low oxygen concentrations, what the weather conditions are like, what time of year you can hike. Like every detail is a brand new novel detail that is really crucial in understanding how to get to the top eventually.
Yeah, like what time of day you have to start out in order to get up there and safely get back down. Because some people, including Hillary, yes, Hillary, and it's a thorny subject, but some people, as far as the mystery of Mallory goes, some people don't consider it a successful ascent unless you come back down. And that's kind of the thing. And I think Hillary was one of those, and his family also said, hey, listen, not to slag anyone, but we kind of only consider it a success if you go up and you're able to come back down and live to tell about it, essentially.
Yeah, and I think that was...
Which is an interesting point.
Yeah, but I think that point was made by Hillary himself, which is kind of like...
Oh, no, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, he's like, well, I mean, even if you made it to the top, it doesn't count.
like I'm doing this interview right now.
Right. I'm sitting here. So there's one thing I want to point out that I don't know has become clear yet. It's clear to me because we did this research and I found out what the deal was. But you might be asking yourself, why was mountain climbing so big at this time? Why were these people doing this? And there's a really good explanation for that. Everest itself was considered the third pole. Because yeah. people had already made it to the South Pole and the North Pole. We didn't yet have the technology to explore the deep ocean or space, and we had been almost everywhere else on Earth. So this was yeah. like the last place for humans to, I guess, basically conquer or pit their endurance against. And that's why it was so attractive to people.
Yes, and that was a very eloquent way to say that. I think we should mention that Mallory himself is the very person who very famously coined the term "because it's there" when asked why they would try to do something like this.
Yeah.
Why climb mountains? Because it's there.
That alone makes him just worth remembering, you know? What a yeah. cool response.
Absolutely.
Why are you going to eat that Big Mac? Because it's there. Right. Everything that's ever come since then where somebody says "because it's there," you're actually quoting George Mallory.
That's right. all right. So let's talk for a second about oxygen. Low oxygen is no good for the human body. And we've mentioned several times that your oxygen levels are very low when you're ascending Everest. Mm-hmm. And these days, they make it really easy on you. It's all, you know, the kind of oxygen they take is very easy to take. They make it very user-friendly. But back then, they had like glassed bottles of oxygen that were carried in like wooden crates. And it was a real pain to get there. It was super, super heavy. But they knew at the time, you know, well, they learned that they would absolutely need this stuff. But Mallory was sort of, I don't think indifferent. I think he was sort of annoyed by the whole thing that you actually had to take this stuff to the point where he didn't even use them, I believe, in the 1921 test run, right?
No, I don't believe so. I don't think he did either in the 1922 expedition that followed, where they actually did try to make Summit. And it wasn't for years before he was like, okay, maybe oxygen's a good idea. Some of them even thought it was like a hindrance in general because it was an extra 30 pounds that you had to carry
yeah.
up this mountain. And if you watch, if you watch video of people climbing Everest today, especially as they get closer and closer to the top and there's less and less mm-hmm. oxygen.
They get less chatty.
Yeah, they do. Even they seem to like have regret for being where they are. Right there. But even with oxygen on, if you watch them, they'll take a step. So 1 foot and then they'll bring the other foot up and maybe they've mm-hmm. traversed a foot of Everest right then. And then they have to wait like 15, 30 seconds before they make the next one because they're that tired because there's that wow. little oxygen. And that's with oxygen on. So these guys were trying these kind of ascents without oxygen. I can't imagine, like, you know, how you would even do that. And it's not clear whether you really could summit Everest without oxygen, although I think people have tried and maybe even been successful. So I guess it would be clear.
Yeah, so in 22, I believe Mallory and a couple of other climbers hit 26,800 feet,
man,
which is remarkable, before they decided to turn back. And again, this is without using oxygen on that 22 mm-hmm. Try. And then this is the part where I was a little bit confused. Maybe you can clear it up. When did the avalanche happen? Was that in 21 where 7 people were killed?
No, yeah. So, no, in 21, there was an avalanche that wiped out some of the camps they'd established but didn't hurt anybody.
Okay.
In 22, they weren't as lucky, and 7 Sherpa died in an avalanche.
All right.
And Mallory kind of considered himself at least partially responsible, even though he wasn't the only person who pushed for this last attempt for the summit. He was one of them, and an avalanche was triggered by that third attempt and killed some of the people further down on the mountain when they were covered up by it.
Yeah, and there are people, you know, who have looked back and kind of poo-pooed Mallory's poo-pooed his carelessness. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if it was carelessness. I don't think it was carelessness just because he was a careless person. I think it was a little more his tenacious attitude sort of overrode good sense sometimes mm-hmm. is the way I took it.
Mm-hmm.
Is that how you took it?
I think that was part of it, but I also get the impression that he was like just downright flighty.
Oh, was he?
Yeah, like there was a, he was in charge of the camera for the 1922 expedition, and apparently he put the film in backwards, but was taking pictures the whole time, and they didn't turn out because he didn't have the film in correctly. Like, that's classic Mallory.
That's an honest mistake, though.
Sure, but if you do that, things like that over and over again, you start to develop a reputation as being flighty.
I guess so. The thing I think is, cameras, like operating a camera wasn't second nature at this point in history. Mm-hmm. And it's like, just give this guy a camera. I don't know. I could see him just being like, I don't even know what this thing is or how to really operate it. Like, don't give it to me. And they're like, well, you kind of have to take it. And he's like, all right, I'll do my best.
Mm-hmm. I mean,
I kind of created that narrative, but
but it was a good one.
He was good at mountain climbing. He may not have been a good photographer.
Okay, fair enough. But there's a very famous quote by a doctor, Tom Longstaff, who was the doctor on the expedition in 1922, who said Mallory was quite unfit to be placed in charge of anything, including himself. So, I mean, people definitely thought of him, I'm going to say flighty again, and I'm not judging, I'm pretty flighty myself. Yumi would certainly tell you that. But I think I recognize it when I see it. Maybe that's what it is.
Is Yumi your Dr. Longstaff?
Yep. I'm going to start calling her that now.
She'll be like, what are you talking about?
I looked that up, too. Remember our surnames episode? I was like, oh, is that a dirty last name?
But I know. That's what I thought.
It turns out if you were a bailiff or somebody involved in law enforcement, you would have then carried like a long stick.
Oh, okay.
To probably beat people with, and that's where they got that name. So his ancestor was involved in law enforcement. I looked it up. I went Longstaff surname penis, and
Dr. Longstaff definitely sounds like a porn name.
It definitely does.
All right, so now let's go to 1924. The test runs had happened, the real attempts had happened, and then finally 1924 rolls around. They didn't just take the year off in 1923 because they were tired. They didn't get funding. Like, it costs a lot of money, and these people aren't like bankrolling themselves. So the Mount Everest Company could not raise the money in 23. So they waited until 1924 when Mallory jumped up in class and said, me mm-hmm. again.
Yeah.
And almost didn't go though, because one of his mates, George Finch, a fellow climber, was, I believe, left off the list. And Mallory was like, if he's not going to go, I'm not there going to go. And they said, okay. And then he went, well, I still want to go.
He put on a fake mustache and put himself down as George Hallory.
Exactly.
So there was a guy who went, who was kind of a surprise selection. His name was Andrew Sandy Irvine. Sorry. And Sandy Irvine was a student still. He was an engineering student. And that's actually one of the reasons they brought him along. He wasn't a schlub as far as mountaineering goes. He just was not nearly as experienced as most of the people on that 1924 expedition. But being an engineering student, he could fiddle and fuss with the oxygen apparatus, which had
in cameras, maybe.
Yeah, probably. He knew how to put the film in the right direction. But since the 1921 and 22 expeditions, it had become clearer to these people on these expeditions, on the 1924 expedition, that oxygen was in fact like really important, and to have somebody who could make these rigs more efficient would be really, really valuable. So they brought Sandy Irvine along.
Yeah, I also saw that Irvine was despite his fiddler's reputation, was strong as an ox.
Yeah, he's
which
huge.
Which is another nice thing.
If you see, there's a famous picture of him and Mallory next to each other facing the camera, like posing for a picture. And he's easily a full head taller than Mallory was, and about as wide, too. So he was a big, big boy.
Yeah, and Mallory was very handsome, too, we should note.
Yes.
Good-looking dude.
He really was. Very pretty, I think you could say.
A pretty man.
Mm-hmm. And then one other note about Mallory on this, to start off this 1924 expedition. Again, this is the third expedition to Everest, and he was the only member of this entire expedition who had been on all three expeditions, which again really underscores Mallory was obsessed with summiting Everest.
That's right. So are we to June 1st now?
I think so, man.
All right. Mallory and George Bruce make this first attempt. This one didn't work out when basically the Sherpa said, all right, we're not going any further. It's too dangerous. And they basically dropped their stuff and turned back. So again, this one didn't work out, but one of the positives is they established a camp at 25,000 feet, which I believe was the tallest camp at the time, or the highest camp.
Okay. Yeah. So that's, again, that's a huge success for a summit attempt, right?
Even right. When more groundwork.
The following day, another couple climbers, Edward Norton and T. Howard Somerville, made their own attempt on the summit. Norton kept going beyond Somerville, and he made it within 1,000 feet of the summit of Everest, which, depending on your perspective, man, sounds really close, but actually isn't, yeah, or is actually super close, even though it sounds far away.
I think it's pretty close.
It is, but if you look at a map and see where 28,000 feet is and then where 29,000 feet is,
I get
he
you.
He had a way to go, but far and away, that was the record. And it was a record that stood, at least officially, until Hillary and Norgay summited Everest in 1953. So it was a big deal. But Norton and Somerville really paid for their attempt. He almost suffocated from a high-altitude cough, and then Norton developed snow blindness because they would wear goggles that were basically sunglass goggles, and you had to wear them during the day, not just from the wind, but because the UV was really, really abundant because of the thin air up there. So you would get what's called snow blindness. You would get keratitis on your corneas, and that's what happened to Norton. He burned his corneas from the reflected sunlight because he didn't keep his goggles on long enough. And on the way back down, from 25,000 feet back down, he had to be helped. Every footstep had to be placed by Sherpas and the doctor on the trip. Every footstep he made all the way back down out of the Everest area.
That's amazing.
It really is.
All right. So on this third attempt, brought Irving. I'm sorry. Why do you keep saying that? I said it because you said it.
Sorry.
Brought Irvine along. And they were sending notes down. You know, they're sending messages back down with Sherpas along the way, basically.
Will you go with
saying,
me?
Yeah, I love you. They were sending notes back down to the other camps, basically giving reports on what's going on, saying things are going well. The weather looks like we should be able to do it. We're gonna try and do this like tomorrow or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so all the notes that were coming down were pretty positive. And basically everything we know about this comes from a gentleman geologist named Noel Odell. It was actually a pretty big hero in this story, too.
Yeah, he was pretty awesome, actually. And he lived to be a ripe old man. Sorry, ripe old age.
he spelled really bad.
Yeah, and there's a really cool interview with him from a Nova episode. I can't remember what it's called, but it's from like the 80s. And they interviewed Noel Odell about this. So he factors in big time in a minute. But Odell was, he went up to one of the high camps. He wanted to look for fossils, being a geologist. He also brought up supplies of food and water to those higher camps to help the climbers on their way back down. And this was the third attempt. Remember, the first attempt didn't work. Second attempt didn't work. It kind of resulted in disaster. And then this third attempt was going to be the last one. And Mallory said, hey, Irvine, why don't you come with me? We're going to try to make the summit of Everest. And there's something that you need to know about this third attempt. Mallory was, I think, 37 maybe by this time. And as far as mountaineers and climbers go, especially back then, he was old. This was probably going to be his last expedition to Everest. And this attempt for the summit was the last attempt on this expedition. Ergo, this was Mallory's last shot at summiting Everest, and he was setting out from the highest camp that had ever been established. Basically, I believe it's the highest camp still today on that north route.
All right. That sounds like a great cliffhanger, no pun intended. So let's take our final break here, and we'll wrap up the story right after this.
Stuff you should know.
Hey, everybody. It's halftime and the scoreboard is not looking good. You're feeling low and not sure you can pull out a win. And that's when you have to dig deep, lift your head up, and say to yourself, time to get back in the game. Pull off some bank heists and take as much of your friends' money as you possibly can.
That's right. The smash hit mobile game Monopoly Go lets you compete with your friends to get the most riches and the biggest empire. It's the Monopoly you love, but on your phone, anytime, with tons of new twists, including leaderboards to compare your progress to your buddies.
That's right. You can play on countless dynamic Monopoly boards. You can make your friends bankrupt by smashing their landmarks with a wrecking ball, and you can charge other players rent for your iconic properties.
Plus, you can even work with your friends to crack open community chests in tournaments to get rewards and climb the leaderboard.
So get back out there, put on your game face, and download Monopoly Go, now free on the App Store or Google Play.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai. There's joy in every journey.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. They push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com/welcometonow. Today's episode is brought to you by Altoids because, let's face it, unraveling the mysteries of the universe is tough work. But with Altoids, your breath will be stronger than a black hole's gravitational pull, more intense than an alien abduction, and more reliable than your phone's battery during a podcast marathon. When it comes to needing intense freshness, Altoids have you covered. Altoids are stronger than your favorite conspiracy theory, more intense than the latest true crime docuseries, and more reliable than a Bigfoot sighting. They're not just mints, they're curiously strong mints. Find Altoids in the checkout aisle. Grab your tin today.
All right. So Mallory is on his last attempt as a human to do the thing that he was obsessed with since he was, you know, a young late teenager.
Right. Beautiful late teenager.
Beautiful, so handsome. Geologist Noel Odell is up there again. He is doing sort of the cool, groovy Appalachian Trail hangout dude thing that
trail
is cooking
magic
for people. Yeah, he's doing some trail magic up there. And at 12:50, he sees Mallory and Irvine on the northeast ridge. But they're a few hours, and this is really key, they're a few hours behind schedule from where they should be. Right. And there's a very narrow window, again, for like what time of day you can pull this off and then safely get back down. So to be a few hours behind schedule is a big deal on whether or not you're going to survive, basically. Mm-hmm. So what he says, and we'll just go ahead and read the quote, what he says he saw is the following. The entire summit ridge and final peak of Everest were unveiled. My eyes became fixed on one tiny black spot beneath a rock step in the ridge. The black spot moved. Another black spot became apparent and moved up the snow to join the other on the crest. The first then approached the great rock step and shortly emerged at the top. The second did likewise.
So right after that, Chuck, apparently the clouds came back. And those two black spots that were he took to be Irvine and Mallory disappeared from view. And that was, if that was Irvine and Mallory, the last time anybody saw them. And Odell would have been the last to see them, which will become a crucial thing later on, as we'll see. But Odell kind of waited for them to come back down to the camps. Remember, he was in the high camps, and he waited and he waited and he waited, and then he started to get really worried. And here's where he became a hero, like you were saying earlier.
Yeah, so Odell is, again, he's not down there at sea level. He is hanging out up there, trying to do the trail magic thing. He's all of a sudden worried, and he basically, from Camp 6, starts hiking around trying to find these guys and doesn't leave. He just keeps staying, and he keeps making these ascents. And I believe, like, 2 days in a row, made an ascent over, what, like 26,000 feet?
Yeah, a couple of them. And he'd go back to camp because he had to, again, to survive. But then he would strike out, like, as soon as he could the next day to look for them.
I mean, that's why he's one of the heroes.
Yeah, exactly. And, like, again, I don't even know if he had oxygen at that point. So he spent a couple of days way up there looking for them. And finally, from the high camp, he signaled back down to the lower camps, the base camp. And there was apparently a prearranged signal that they had come up with for this third summit attempt. And Odell laid it out. It was six sleeping bags laid out in a cross, which meant death, that they had died, that they hadn't made it. And so in reply, the guy who led the expedition had a return signal saying, like, give up hope, come back down. And very sadly, Odell did as he was instructed and came back down without Irvine, without Mallory, who remained up on the mountain as far as anyone knew.
Yeah, and at this point, he had been up there for, and this is over 23,000 feet. He had been up there for 11 days.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I mean, surely no, I don't think that had been done before, right?
That's no picnic caught in a snowstorm. That's some serious stuff.
Yeah, and there's no way that these guys, I mean, they were up there for two nights, and you're not going to survive one night. So
right.
It was pretty clear those sleeping bags had to come out at that point.
Yeah, and so they said, you know, they were really kind of unhappy on that way back down, which, again, I don't think we said. If you're coming up a mountain, you have to acclimate over weeks, little by little. And I believe you have to do roughly the same thing coming back down. So these guys had to basically have this party where two people had been lost on their summit attempt, and they were glum. But at the same time, they realized, like, you know, Mallory and Irvine had kind of embodied this spirit of adventure and just trying and even risking your life for, you know, this noble attempt at something no one else had ever done. So it was kind of a bittersweet thing, their loss was. It wasn't entirely nothing but tragic. There was some silver lining to it in the way that Mallory was remembered and thought of.
Yeah, absolutely. And from that moment forward, there, you know, Ed kind of makes it sound like the consensus is that they never reached the top. And after reading all this stuff and a lot of other opinions, I don't think that's true at all. Yeah. I think there is still debate on whether or not they actually made it to the top. And there are a bunch of cool little clues that kind of lead you down one way or the other along the way.
Yeah, one of them, Chuck, was Odell and what he saw. And there's a couple of things you need to know about Odell. Number one, he was a geologist, and a lot of people say he just mistook some rocks for Irvine and Mallory, the little tiny dots he thought he saw moving. He's a geologist, yeah, making him very unlikely to mistake rocks for people. And then secondly, he was well known to have really good eyesight. Apparently, he didn't need glasses until he was in his 90s. So those Whoa. Two things combined make it seem like he was probably the best possible eyewitness around. And Odell went to his grave saying, I saw them. They were moving. It was them. But exactly where he saw them kind of came up for grabs.
Yeah. So there are these three cliffs, sort of, you know, if you go this route, there are three cliffs to get to the top. And they call them steps, step one, step two, step three. Mm-hmm. They didn't know about these steps until they got there, obviously, because no one had done this yet. And from what he was talking about, he saw them on the second step, but there are a lot of people today that said, no, I think he probably saw them on the first step. At one point in his life, he said that it was the first step, but then he went back and said, no. And I don't know if he was just sort of a victim of kind of listening to what other people had to say. Mm-hmm. But apparently later in life, he went back and was adamant that it was the second step that he saw them on.
Oh, really? Okay, cool. So here's the thing. If you are in the climbing community and you believe that at the very least Mallory, if not Mallory and Irvine, made it to the top of Everest on that 1924 expedition on that third attempt, the reason you think that is because you believe that Odell did see them climb up that second step, because that second step was the last great obstacle to the top. And had they made it up the second step, nothing would have stopped Mallory from continuing on to hit the summit. Knowing that he probably would not ever make it down alive, he still would have kept going on. So that's what a lot of people think. The people who think that he actually did make it kind of point to Odell's eyewitness statements.
Yeah, and that's in that interview when he was, what, he was 97 years old. Mm-hmm. Odell himself says that, you know, there would have been nothing that would have stopped Mallory and Irvine, he believes, even though dusk was approaching, and they probably knew it was a suicide mission at that point.
Right.
His feeling was that there's no way they would have stopped too.
Yeah, because we didn't say when those clouds came around, they brought with them a blizzard too. So it was really terrible conditions. They were way late in the day. There was basically no chance if they summited that they could get back to that highest camp in time for surviving the night. But that would not have stopped them, because they just would have kept going. That's just what Mallory would have done. And pretty much everybody agrees on that. The distinction is whether he was on the first step or the second step. Because if he was just on the first step, he still had that second step ahead of him. He might not have made it. If he made the second step, he definitely summited. That seems to be what the consensus is.
All right. So you've got that. We can park that to the side. In the subsequent years on different expeditions, there have been little bits and pieces of evidence found along the way. One in 1933, when Irvine's ice axe was found. And, you know, you're not going to just leave your ice axe behind.
Right.
So basically, they concluded that something happened that made Irvine drop this ice axe. But they recovered it in 33. And then in 1975, there were some Chinese climbers who made a successful summit all the way to the top. And they were the only ones that could have gone this way, because like we said earlier, the Chinese route was shut down basically to Americans. And so it's not like that people before the 1975 would have been taking this route. I think there was one American group that snuck in and did so illegally.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the Chinese climbers said, "I found an English dead," to another climber. China has always denied this and said that that's not true. And that it was a misunderstanding. And then that climber actually, his name was Wang Hongbao, died the next day in an avalanche. So there was never like any follow-up with him.
In a really interesting, ironic twist, Chuck, Hongbao translates to longstaff in English.
No, really?
I thought I'd get a bigger laugh out of that. We'll just edit that out.
Well, it was believable enough to where I couldn't quite tell.
So there's all this intrigue that's kind of gathering around this idea that the Chinese had found at least one dead Englishman on their side of the mountain, the north side, the Tibetan side, where they shouldn't have been, which means that, it had to have been Irvine or Mallory. So there was an expedition there was a 1991 expedition that found an old oxygen bottle that was almost certainly Mallory or Irvine's. And then all of that information kind of came together to support a 1999 Nat Geo expedition to actually find Irvine or Mallory. And they actually did. They found one of them. And at first they thought it was Irvine, right?
Yeah, they did. But they found Mallory. He was frozen. He was sun bleached. His body was very well preserved. The items on him were very well preserved.
Mm-hmm.
They found him severely injured. Well, they found a couple of things. They found that he had a severely broken leg and some rope trauma, like ligature stuff around his waist. But what they really found that was severe was the cause of death, which was a golf ball size hole in his forehead.
Yeah, and it was a puncture wound. So they think it's possible as he was falling that his ice axe bounced off of a rock and into his head, which that'd be pretty merciful on the way down if you think about it, if that killed him instantly. Yeah. Because they said that his foot was almost broken off, that break was so bad. And then rope trauma, too. Imagine a rope yanking on you, because they found the rope still tied around his waist.
I've had that happen, actually. I can't imagine it. I mean,
it's awful, right? It's like falling on your tailbone, but times a million. And the other end of the rope was snapped off. And I saw a climber say because of that snap, it must have been tied to something really immobile, like a rock, rather than Irvine. So that suggested that Mallory had sent Irvine back and tried to make the summit himself, which a lot of people kind of give to his credit, that he wasn't willing to risk Irvine's life, only his own.
I find it very strange that I said that that happened to me and you didn't even ask what that was about.
Well, I was on a roll.
It's very strange.
What happened?
I'm not even gonna tell you now.
What happened?
No one gets to know.
All right.
That would be the great mystery of this episode.
Okay.
So the two big clues here as to whether or not he made it are, well, one big clue was he didn't have that picture of his wife on him. This is the picture that he took with him everywhere, that he vowed to place at the top of the mountain. And it wasn't on him. So a lot of people look at that and say, well, it's not on him because he actually did, maybe by himself or maybe with Irvine, make it to the summit and place that picture there. And it's not like you would have necessarily found that picture years later. It very probably would have blown away or, you know, been destroyed by the elements over time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I don't know how I feel about that clue. I think it's considering everything was found really in good condition on him and that he didn't have it is pretty interesting to think about. I'll just say that.
I like that clue too. There's also a missing camera. They took a camera with them for that third attempt, a Kodak Vest Pocket Camera, VPK. And it's like one of those old cameras with the accordion that you pull out, but it is a really small, like pocket-sized version. And had they made it to the summit, they absolutely would have taken a photograph from the summit. And if you could just find that camera, then you could conceivably, because it had been in deep freeze conditions for all these years, it's possible using modern techniques that you could develop that film and solve this mystery once and for all. But the problem is this, Chuck, the camera's missing, and so is Irvine, because there was an expedition not too long ago, a few years back, that set out to look for Irvine, this other guy, because where the Chinese expedition said that they found the dead English, that is nowhere near where Mallory was found. So they figure that they found Irvine, but when this expedition, I think a couple of years ago, went back to find Irvine, there was nothing there. His body was not exactly where it should be, nothing there. And so this rumor has kind of come up over the years that the Chinese actually found him and brought him back down the mountain without telling anybody.
That's right. That is the rumor, and that they got that camera and they kind of botched the film trying to get it developed and process those pictures, and that was a big embarrassment, and so they will take that secret to their graves.
Yeah, and another explanation is that the 1960 Chinese expedition to the top of the North Face was the first to summit the North Face, and that they were protecting national pride because they found evidence on that camera, on that film, when they did develop it, that Mallory had made it to the top. Who knows? The thing is, we'll never know, right? Ever. The thing that we will know, I think, eventually, though, Chuck, hopefully, is what happened with your rope trauma.
That will go to the grave with me.
Oh, man, I really botched that, like the Chinese mountain climbers botched processing that film.
Okay, Longstaff.
Long-winded's more like it. You got anything else?
I got nothing else.
All right, everybody. Well, since Chuck refuses to tell us about his rope trauma story, I guess we have nothing left but listener mail.
This is from the Silly String app. This is Myth Busted. Hey guys, just wanted to point out that Josh repeated a widely spread myth about telegrams in the Silly String episode that stop was used because punctuation cost extra. Mm-hmm. This myth has been busted. The real story is Morse code originally had only capital letters and no punctuation. Mm-hmm. It's generally not much of a problem, but during the First World War, when the telegrams were widely used in the military, a misunderstood message could be disastrous. So the custom arose of using the word stop between sentences in military telegrams so that any ambiguous phrases could not be misinterpreted. Caught on with the public, even after punctuation was introduced, people continued fashionably using stop between sentences, even though they didn't have to. I thought this was kind of interesting. Thanks for the great show. And that is from Dave.
It is very interesting, Dave. I like both stories. Okay?
They're both great.
Yeah, everyone wins. And also, I'm going to posit that you have mentioned before that you've gone rappelling as a Boy Scout and that it happened somewhere on Stone Mountain.
Not true. The mystery continues.
Whatever. If you want to get in touch with us like Dave did and maybe take a crack at what happened with Chuck and the rope and the trauma, you can send us an email to stuffpodcast@iheartradio.com.
Stuff You Should Know is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
The first cell phone was demonstrated in 1973 by Martin Cooper. But you know what wasn't demonstrated? Shared plans. Over 50 years later, you can save on one line, thanks to Visible. It's true. So switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon for just $25 a month, taxes and fees included. Switch now at Visible.com.
Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. It's a simple truth. No matter who you are, mental health challenges can affect you, and how you manage them can make all the difference. That's why everyone should have access to mental health support that meets them where they are and helps them get through. BetterHelp provides online therapy on your schedule. It's flexible, simple to use, and more affordable than in-person therapy. Connect with a licensed therapist selected just for you. Learn more at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com.
In Puerto Rico, there's adventure around every corner and natural treasures waiting to be explored, like El Yunque, the only tropical rainforest in the U.S. Get swept away by natural beauty and come away with unique stories that could only be experienced in Puerto Rico and that remind you why you travel in the first place. Visits end, but stories last forever. You don't become a part of the island, it becomes a part of you. No passports required for U.S. citizens and permanent residents. Learn more and plan your trip at discoverpuertorico.com.
Hey, everybody. I want to talk to you for a second here about Canva, specifically Canva presentations that are designed for every workplace and every department. Whether you work in sales, marketing, HR, ops, and more, Canva presentations can generate any deck you want for work. Sales decks, marketing presentations, onboarding plans, you name it. Any department can save time on any presentation. So start designing today at canva.com. Design for work. Just go to Canva, C-A-N-V-A.com.